Everybody? Time for us to get started. We are in Judges chapter 9. And we're going to jump right in. On Thursday, we finished our class by reading through all of Judges chapter 9 and kind of getting the whole story in one sitting. The story of this man, Abimelech, the son of Gideon. And one of the things that we asked ourselves at the end of class was, you look at this story, it doesn't really fit the typical pattern of Judges' stories as we are used to seeing them in the book of Judges. Right, so Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivers them over into the hands of plunderers. In this case, the plunderer is Abimelech. But then from there out, the rest of the pattern is not really there. Israel never cries out to the Lord for deliverance. There's no judge in this story. And ultimately, at the end of this story, we're not going to get any kind of notice about the land being at peace for any amount of time, any number of years, like we normally get in judge stories. And so what we're left with is this question, and we're going to consider this at the end of class, or once we get through this story. Why has the Spirit included this story in the book of Judges? What's it have to do with the book of Judges? All right, so our study in Abimelech begins, and we talked about this on Thursday, begins with his name. All right, remember in chapter 8, Gideon had said to Israel, I'm not going to rule over you. My sons will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you, which sounds really nice and pious. And then he turns around and he asks everybody for their golden earrings. He makes an idol out of it. And then he has 70 legitimate sons, which is not something that just anybody does in antiquity. And then he has an illegitimate son that he names Abimelech, which means my dad is king. So, we asked ourselves on Thursday, you know, how credulous are we of Gideon whenever he says, I won't rule over you, my son won't rule over you, the Lord will rule over you. Sounds really nice and pious, but then he turns around and he does stuff like this. And we're going to see the fruit of this in today's reading. So let's begin in Judges chapter 9, verse 1. Now Abimelech the son of Jerubbaal went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for he said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berit, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. And he went to his father's house at Ophrah, and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. And all the leaders of Shechem came together, and all Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. So this passage puts the main conflict of the chapter in front of us, along with the backdrop of idolatry that's going on in Israel. Remember that Israel has sought to make Gideon a dynastic ruler over them. So they've not just asked Gideon to rule over them, but to establish a dynasty, right? Let you and your son and your son's son rule over us. Well, now Gideon has died, and although he refused, at least in word, that question of a ruling dynasty still lingers. Right? Now that Gideon is dead, what's going to happen? And Abimelech is able to ask the men of Shechem whether they would prefer to be ruled by the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, who are Manassites, or by one man, Abimelech, who is a fellow Ephraimite. Remember, the city of Shechem is the sanctuary city in the tribe of Ephraim. But he's Abimelech is able to come to them and say, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? All right, so this question of dynasty, again, is still lingering. Now, did the sons of Gideon actually rule over Israel? Did they ever rule over Shechem? Or was Abimelech just manipulating their fears? The text doesn't say. And the way that Gideon was acting at the end of the last chapter, honestly, it could go either direction. But whatever the case may be, Abimelech's ploy works. The men of Shechem side with Abimelech. They fund him so that he gathers up a band of mercenaries, and they eventually coronate Abimelech. Now, for Abimelech to secure his claim as ruler, he kills his 70 half-brothers. He takes his band of brigands up to Ophrah in Manasseh, Gideon's ancestral home, so the house not just of Gideon, but of Gideon's fathers before him. And they execute all of his brothers except for one, Yotam, who manages to escape, Gideon's youngest son. All right, so this is going to be, this is what makes the central conflict of the Abimelech story. He wants to be ruler, Shechem supports him, and he goes and kills the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, the 70 sons of Gideon. In the backdrop of all of this is idolatry. All right, we're told at the end of chapter 8 that Israel, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berit their god. All right, remember, Baal just means Lord or Master. The word Berit means covenant. So they're worshiping this god named Lord of the Covenant, which, I mean, all idolatry is perverse, but this seems particularly perverse, that they have made an idol that they call Lord of the Covenant. Yeah, that should strike pretty close to home, because the God of Israel identifies himself as a God who keeps covenant with Israel. And in fact, it may be that they're attempting to worship the God of Israel, but they have tried to make a graven image out of him, much as Aaron does with the golden calf. Remember, Aaron makes the calf and he tells Israel, "This is the God who brought you up out of Egypt." Right? So it's not necessarily that perhaps Israel's not trying to go after another God, but breaking the second commandment and completely misunderstanding who their God is. Of course, Baal Berit might also just be a Canaanite God that they've decided to follow. But in any case, they're worshiping Baal Berit. Then the ESV tells us that the leaders of Shechem come together to coronate Abimelech. It probably would have been better if they'd said the lords of Shechem, because the narrator of Judges engages in a little fun with us in this chapter, a little wordplay, because the word that's translated leaders is Baals, right? The Baals of Shechem, not the idol Baal. Remember, Baal just means Lord or Master. So when he says the Baals of Shechem came together and all Bet-Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king, right? It's the lords of Shechem. But it's a reminder to us that Israel at this time has given itself over to the Baals. This wordplay is going to continue throughout the chapter, by the way. Gideon is consistently referred to by his other name, Jerubbaal. All right, so we're going to have that word Baal in front of us constantly in this chapter. All right, and we're going to see forms of Baal, you know, and king, so Lord, Master, King, all through the chapter. All right, that's going to be one of the big motifs of this story. All right, in addition to that, the people of Bet-Millo join the people of Shechem in coronating Abimelech. A millo is an artificial hill. So it usually would be built up, like some kind of wooden superstructure underneath it. They cover it in dirt, make a big artificial mound. And usually they were big enough to support buildings on top of them. And usually it was dominated by one building, the House of the Millo, which is what Bet Millo means. Bet means house. Wayne? Not a pyramid, but remember, all kinds of big earthworks like pyramids shared is some of the same essential functions, right? Like sometimes they would be burial plots for dead kings. Usually they were worship sites.
That's what we find out in North America was a lot of Indians would build this huge mound.
Yeah, and it's interesting how consistent that is across cultures and across places. Everybody's got this, it's like it's this baked-in instinct to build mounds. As sacred places. Yeah. And I think that's exactly how we're supposed to understand Bet Millo. All right, the House of the Millo, Bet Millo, again, probably refers to some kind of a sacred space like a temple. That's what these things usually were in antiquity. It might even be, because this is associated with Shechem, this might even be the temple of Baal Berit that we're talking about. And so Judges is telling us not just the lords of Shechem, but also the priestly class or whoever's at Bet Millo, this house that is, again, perhaps an idol's house. And this coronation takes place by the oak of the pillar of Shechem. A better translation would be the oak of the standing stone of Shechem. In other words, at another pagan worship site. Standing stones are set up as places of idol worship in antiquity. And so this oak by the standing stone is likely a sacred oak. All right, so their idolatry is just all over the place in the backdrop of this story. All right, so we'll see these things tied together. Israel's idolatry, wanting to go after another lord, and this decision that they have made to anoint Abimelech as their earthly lord. And we're going to see, again, that the consequences of these decisions are tied together because they are of a piece with each other. All right. Any questions or comments before we get to the next passage? Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, we already covered this journey over here and we're talking about God. But we always think about Israel kings happening after Samuel.
Right, we think of kings being a later period.
But here's
a king.
Already, we already have two.
Mm-hmm. If you count Baal Berit. Yeah. Well, if you count Gideon.
Count Gideon and Abimelech.
Yeah.
We don't think about that.
Gideon at least has the sense not to formalize his pretensions. So he never serves as a king. He just lives like one. Right. And he makes these little claims like that, naming his son, "My dad is king." Again, he's never formally coronated or anything. He's just extremely coy about it. Right, he as at the same time that he's living as a king, he says, "No, I'm not going to be king." Abimelech, the only thing that changes with Abimelech is he says, "No, I want you to call me king." Go ahead.
Okay, that reminds me. It sounds familiar because a lot of churches nowadays do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
They don't have elders, but they've got the. They might as well go ahead and call elders all the week.
Yeah. That is something that I think perhaps a good modern application is that we have to be extremely careful about the way that we practice authority, because not everything is bound up in a formal title, right? There are people who take authority for themselves that don't take the title for themselves, and that's still illegitimate.
Pastorizing
yeah.
the church.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's read ahead. Oh, yes, sir. Oh, yeah, Rena. I think that's a, well, let's hold on to that thought for a little bit, because we definitely get that indication here, right? Their first experiment with monarchy goes horribly, horribly wrong for them. And of course, we know later on, their second experiment goes wrong too. In the middle of all of this, more or less, yeah, more or less. In the middle of all of this, the narrator of Judges later on in the book is going to tell us about all of these bad things that are going on, because in those days there was no king in the land, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Right, but we're seeing right now that things are still just as bad in Israel when they do have a king. So it's not... The short answer is, it's not necessarily that God doesn't want Israel to have a king. In fact, he legislates for it in the book of Deuteronomy. Right? There are laws pertaining to Israel's king when they eventually get one. The point is that it doesn't really matter whether Israel is under a king or under judges, or under any other kind of political arrangement, they are going to be rotten and faithless. And they cannot find a political solution to their wickedness. I think it's a useful lesson for us to remember today. All right, verse 7. When it was told to Yotam, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, "Listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go hold sway over the trees?' And the trees said to the fig tree, 'You come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees?' And the trees said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?' Then all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come and reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now therefore, if you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done to him as his deeds deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, and you have risen up against my father's house this day and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his female slave, king over the leaders of Shechem, because he's your relative. If then you have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house to this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo and devour Abimelech.' And Yotam ran away and fled and went to Beer and lived there, because of Abimelech, his brother." All right, so Yotam, Gideon's surviving son, confronts the men of Shechem with a parable. We're not told why he feels confident enough to come out and confront them in this way. It's evident at the end of the chapter, or the end of the passage rather, that he fears Abimelech and he runs off. Remember that Shechem lies in the valley between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. Right, so we're again looking about here on the map, and on one side you'd have Mount Ebal, on the other side Mount Gerizim. So Yotam is able to stand on top of Mount Gerizim and address the city down in the valley. And he tells this parable about the trees seeking a king. The trees are not able to find a king of any value. Right, the olive tree, the fig tree, the grapevine, they all turn the trees down. And so, instead, the trees must resign themselves to coronating this worthless bramble. And Yotam's meaning is pretty obvious in all of this. This is an extremely thinly veiled parable. Right, Abimelech is like the bramble and like the mercenary band that he has hired. He is a worthless fellow. He brings nothing to the table. Right, the olive tree, the fig tree, the vine, they all have their wealth, their abundance. They're useful. They're desirable. The bramble, not so. And Abimelech is the bramble. In fact, the whole Abimelech story is full of parties who claim to be kings and lords who are not worthy of the name. The bramble's challenge in the parable introduces the major theme of this parable, which is the theme of the whole Abimelech story, and ultimately the theme of the entire Gideon cycle. If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. All right, is this an arrangement that has been arrived at in good faith? Yotam leaves nothing to interpretation. Right, he explains the parable. He challenges the way that Shechem has treated the house of Gideon by entering into their agreement with Abimelech. And he frames everything in terms of if, right? If you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as his deeds deserve, if you have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day. Right, but we understand that there's really no question of whether or not Shechem has dealt in good faith and integrity with the house of Jerubbaal. The narrator has already told us explicitly at the end of chapter 8, in verse 35, that they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. And Yotam himself, I think, is pretty clear in what he thinks, right? My father fought for you, risked his life. You've risen up against his house, killed 70 of his sons. There's nothing to doubt here. And so, in declaring the moral of the parable, Yotam's parable is announcing a curse, that the relationship between Shechem and Abimelech is bound to mirror the relationship between Shechem and Jerubbaal. Right, that just as they have dealt treacherously with the house of Jerubbaal, so will they also deal treacherously with each other. For their faithlessness, Abimelech and Shechem are going to devour each other. Any questions or comments about that parable before we continue next? Saul?
Is there any connection with Mark 8:25 when Jesus heals the blind man?
I'm not sure. I would need to sit on that and give that some thought for a bit. John?
What's the significance of the phrase, and devour the cedars of Lebanon? I think of cedars of Lebanon, I think it's straight, right?
Uh-huh.
Is that the reason why they're using that reference? Because the cedars of Lebanon were so big?
I think so. It's useful in this parable. Yeah, if we understand those trees to be cedars of Lebanon, then, yeah, they're people who are strong. From a worldly standpoint, it might look like things are going well in Shechem, and that Shechem has a lot of power. But what Yotam is declaring is that it doesn't matter how strong they are. Ultimately, this treachery of theirs is going to destroy them. Right? Just like how this relationship between the trees and the bramble is going to lead to their destruction.
The parable of the trees, the kind of the impression that I get as you read it is that the olive tree didn't want to give up its roots to become the king. The fig tree didn't want to give up his roots to be the king. You know, they were happy right where they were at.
Yeah, kingship is a burden.
Yeah, it was something they got there. They had everything they needed. Why would I go take this stress on and add this stress to my life? But, like when I read the story, when I hear the story, I'm drawn back to Abraham with Ishmael and Isaac, you know, and the two different sons of Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
Ishmael was from the maidservant or the slave girl, correct? And
yeah.
We've seen how these brothers from different
women
are just like oil and water. They just don't connect. You see that throughout Scripture.
Yeah, and that's an interesting parallel. That you could see Abimelech as a parallel to Ishmael, almost. So, excellent. Good point. All right, let's continue. Verse 22. Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. And God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against him on the mountaintops, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way, and it was told to Abimelech. All right, the narrator confirms Yotam's curse for us immediately. Again, it's not left to any doubt or interpretation for us. And for the first time in quite a few verses, the narrator shows us God acting explicitly. Right, there have been a lot of points in the Gideon story, particularly after he hears the dream and its interpretation, where sometimes it's not clear where God is acting, sometimes it's not clear where Gideon is acting on his own. Here it's explicit for us. God is doing this. God sends an evil spirit between Abimelech and Shechem. And so just as they have betrayed the house of Jerubbaal, so shall they also betray each other. And the narrator tells us explicitly that this is to bring their treachery back on their own heads. Right? We get the moral sense of this story and declared for us in no uncertain terms. And this should stand out to us, by the way, considering how the narrator normally reports things, right? We've seen him be pretty coy in reporting certain things throughout the story. But here he is clear, he's explicit about God's involvement and about framing these events as the consequences of wickedness, of immorality. All right, this part of the conflict starts with Shechem, the lords of Shechem, again, the Baals of Shechem, turning to highwaymen. Right, another a band of raiders, people who lie in ambush. They're a parallel to Abimelech's mercenaries, and we're going to see some more people in ambush later through the story. And again, it just gives us a sense of the moral state of things, that everybody's lying in ambush over the course of this story. Everybody's a worthless man. Everybody is a brigand or a highwayman. It starts with highwaymen, but it's going to expand pretty much immediately into full insurrection. Let's continue into verse 26. And Gaal the son of Ebed moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and reviled Abimelech. And Gaal the son of Ebed said, "Who is Abimelech, and who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? Would that this people were under my hand, then I would remove Abimelech. I would say to Abimelech, 'Increase your army and come out.'" When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was kindled, and he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and they are stirring up the city against you. Now therefore, go by night, you and the people who are with you, and set an ambush in the field. Then in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as your hand finds to do. So Abimelech and all the men who were with him rose up by night and set an ambush against Shechem in four companies. And Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. And Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from the ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops." And Zebul said to him, "You mistake the shadow of the mountains for men." Gaal spoke again and said, "Look, people are coming down from the center of the land, and one company is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak." Then Zebul said to him, "Where is your mouth now, you who said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Are not these the people whom you despised? Go out now and fight with them." So Gaal went out at the head of the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech, and Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived at Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not dwell at Shechem. All right, so the story introduces this guy, Gaal, the son of Ebed. Gaal comes from the Hebrew word for loathing, and Ebed is the Hebrew word for slave. All right, so we've got this part of the story opens with, then Loathsome, the son of slave, moved into Shechem. What a name. Loathsome. We have no doubts about what's going to come of him. And of course, the men of Shechem put their confidence in this newcomer named Loathsome. Again, it just tells you something about the state of things. This guy named Loathsome moves into town, and the lords of Shechem think, here's our guy. We're going to put confidence in him. Now, it happens that the city holds a festival for their god, presumably Baal Berit. The festival centers on wine. And so Gaal engages in some, I presume he's drunk here, engages in some drunken boasting, talking about what he'd do to Abimelech if given the chance. Right? This kind of thing happens often enough that it's a trope. You know, you get enough alcohol in a guy and he can conquer the whole world in his own mind. And he frames things, by the way, in the same kinds of terms that Abimelech did at the beginning. Right? Abimelech said it would be better if Shechem were ruled by one man rather than 70. Gaal says it would be better if Shechem were ruled by the descendants of Hamor rather than by Abimelech. You might remember Hamor, by the way, from the story of Shechem and Dinah back in Genesis chapter 34. This is the Hamor he's referring to. The men of Hamor. In other words, Gaal is calling for Shechem to return to its Canaanite roots as the city of Hamor. And it seems like the men of Shechem are willing to go along with this, just like they were willing to go along with Abimelech at the beginning. But it just so happens that an ally of Abimelech, named Zebul, who is the city manager, the city ruler, he's present for all of this, and we begin to see just how stupid Gaal and the men of Shechem are, because they're making these boasts in front of Zebul, who they know to be an ally of Abimelech. They even call him out by name as they are making these boasts. Right, look at Zebul over here. Isn't he Abimelech's officer? Well, you know what? If Abimelech were here and I was in charge of everything, I sure would whoop Abimelech. Right, that's what Gaal says. So naturally, Zebul reports all of this to Abimelech, and he advises him, come and attack the city. Right, first off, he knows that the city is led by a moron. Come attack the city. You can do as your hand finds to do. And this ambush gives us, again, another comedic glimpse into Gaal's stupidity. As he suspects that he sees people coming down from the mountains against the city, and of all people, and again, Gaal knows that Zebul is Abimelech's man, but as he's saying, I think there's people coming down from the mountain, he listens to Zebul when Zebul says, oh, no, that's just the shadows. You know, your mind's playing tricks on you. But by the time that Gaal realizes what's going on, it's too late. He goes out to battle anyway. Abimelech defeats him. He's driven out of Shechem. And the immediate threat to Abimelech's rule is gone. But we're going to see on Thursday that Abimelech is not finished with Shechem. We're going to see that beginning in the next passage. But we are out of time for today. So thank you so much for your questions and comments and your kind attention this morning. We will finish up the Abimelech story and then probably do Tola and Yair and... who comes after Yair? I've done forgotten his name. We'll try to cover them on Thursday, Lord willing. So thank you very much.